Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. Episode 13, Mentoring with Sian Wickersham. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, where we're returning to a topic that we've talked about quite a few times over our 7-year existence so far, but we have no shame in going back to it because of its importance to our day job, and that is mentoring, which is that very important person out in school who takes a student teacher who might be on a university course such as ours and looks after them while they're on placement. And I'm joined by two mentoring experts. One is Emma, my co-presenter, but we've also got a friend of the podcast who is back for more.
Hello, everybody. So I'm Sian Wickersham, and I'm one of the mentoring leads here at Cardiff Met, working with Emma and our colleague, Kerry Bevan, who's not with us today.
Yeah, and I'm not sure about that term expert. Do you feel like an expert yet, Sian? You're more expert than I am because you've been doing this gig for longer than I have.
Yeah, I guess maybe person who is very interested in mentoring, but that's got less of a ring.
Yeah, so yeah
we'll,
it does.
We'll claim it. Let's just lean into it.
You're both more expert than I am, so there you go. I'm bottom of the heap today. And we had Professor Trevor Mutton in the other day talking in quite broad terms about philosophies of teacher education and how people learn and all of that stuff. It was really, really knotty, but we were tending to talk in a little bit in the abstract. Today, we're going to talk specifically about the work that we've done here in Cardiff Met to develop our vision for mentoring, our vision for how the students learn with their mentors, and to really move things on a little bit and give our mentors a bit of love. So, Emma, what are we actually going to be discussing in detail today?
Yeah, okay. So just a little bit of context. We work as mentor leads. We have a responsibility to mentors to ensure that they are fully trained, that they are engaged in professional learning, to develop their mentoring practice or the teacher education practice. And aside from the fact that that takes up the bulk of our time, we've had a bit of extra time this year. And I think having come into this a little bit later and sort of having the benefit of listening to Sian and Sally Bethel's experiences of doing this role, I can see that we've sort of had this professional itch that we've needed to scratch, really, about the role of the mentor within a clinical practice model of teacher education that we have here in the Cardiff Partnership, and feeling a little bit like we don't necessarily have our story straight on what it means to be a mentor within that model of teacher education. So that was the sort of itch that we really felt that we needed to scratch. And we felt that we would like a little bit of support from someone that's got some expertise in this area. So actually, Professor Trevor Mutton was the person who we called upon to guide us in that. We had some ideas. We knew a lot about the challenges that mentors in our model face and the student teachers. We know a lot about the ambitions of our vision of how student teachers learn. We know a lot about clinical practice as a model of teacher education. And so we felt that we need to get around a table as a team with Trevor, who was able to provide us with 4 really stimulating research articles about mentoring, mentors, mentoring practice generally, so that we can sort of chew it all over, lay it all out on the table. And what we arrived at, which is what we're going to talk about today, is that we needed some sort of underlying fundamental principles for mentoring that would sort of help us to work with mentors in a way that would enable them, give them the sort of qualities, values, dispositions, knowledge, practical expertise to be able to be a mentor within that model.
And I think one of the things that we have been wondering is whether we are focusing a bit too much on that to-do list for mentors, because there is an awful lot for mentors to do. And when mentors come for professional learning, especially when they're new, the tendency and our kind of temptation, I guess, has been to help them work through that to-do list. So here are all the different things you need to do. Here are the forms you need to fill in. Here are some good examples of those forms filled in and all of that stuff. But actually, some of the foundations of what it means to be a mentor specifically specifically in a research-informed clinical practice model perhaps have been lost a little bit. And I think as well, with the change landscape at the moment, often we can focus quite a lot on the challenges and the differences between schools and the differences that student teachers are having in their experience. But actually, there are some foundational principles, I guess, of what it is that we're hoping that all mentors will fulfill. So during the process of our reading and talking to Professor Trevor Mutton, we actually kind of had a bit of a revelation that we're focusing maybe a bit much on, oh, we can't do that because of this reason, and oh, that wouldn't work in this type of school. And actually looking at those common threads and common themes around what makes an effective mentor within our particular model was perhaps something that was worth exploring. And so that's what we've been doing. And we're still in the middle of it, it's worth saying.
Yes.
This form at the moment, not form, this kind of list of principles has got draft written all over it. And we keep saying it's a very drafty draft.
It's a very drafty draft.
Very drafty draft. Well, this rings to me true with a lot of the stuff we've said about the general education landscape, isn't it? Which is that we've got a very aspirational sort of mood over here in Wales. There's a little bit of a different mood to the mood over the border in England, perhaps in some ways. We've gone very developmental and very sort of holistic with things like the standards, with things like the review of ITE, things like curriculum for Wales. And yet we have said in the past, haven't we, that teacher education then slams into a brick wall of a binary decision, which doesn't exist anywhere else, which is, do you pass them or do you not pass them? Do you give them qualified teacher status or do you not? And then you're sort of walking a fence, I suppose, between how much aspirational do we do and how much do we make sure we can prove we've got it right and we've got the paper trail.
Yes, and this is something that we are acutely aware of, I would say, is that, you know, and worth listeners knowing that in Wales, mentors are responsible for awarding, and we as the institution award QTS, but in making the decision as to whether QTS can be conferred or not, it's on the mentor. And from our reading, I think we've become quite confident. I think we always knew this, but that is absolutely the right call. They see them the most regularly. But yeah, you're right, Tom. They're working within a very aspirational educational climate. However, as is an issue that we've pointed out in other aspects of education reform in Wales, very little time and space is given to mentors. And in fact, I would probably say, I don't know this is an absolute fact, but I would put money on mentoring being one of those priorities that again and again ITE providers have on their action list, on their area for development, recommendations from ESTIN or the likes of the Education Workforce Council. It's just one of those perennial issues, you know, the quality of mentoring. And I think that kind of speaks to and in some ways sort of devalues it paradoxically the importance of that role. It's like it keeps coming back and we need to improve the quality of them. Obviously that's because they work with them the largest percent of the time, and yet we don't have the money to really make a difference to the things that, you know, would make a difference to their role, I think, which is time and space.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well that over the border in England, they have recently dialed back on their requirement for mentors to have a certain number of hours of training. And again, it's sort of, it's all very well and good saying mentors should have X hours of training. I think, was it 30? 30
yes.
hours?
Yeah. It was, we were astonished, weren't we?
We were astonished and jealous.
Yes.
Because we want to have 30 hours of training with our training professional learning with our mentors. But actually, until there are the structures in place in schools to value the role and to actually provide the time, just making it a requirement that there's X amount of training isn't necessarily going to help. Mm. And I think the other thing that really resonates with us is mentors are already doing an awful lot incredibly well. Mm. And the feedback that we get from our schools and from our student teachers is always absolutely fantastic. We have sort of on average 92-93% of our student teachers rating basically anything that a mentor does is excellent or good, mm-hmm. which is some quite incredible feedback, because we know that the PGCE and the undergraduate course is a really challenging one.
Yes.
And there's lots of opportunities for things not to go very well. So the fact that we've got such high percentages of children, of student teachers saying really good things about their mentors is absolute testament to the brilliant job that they're doing. But as Emma says, I think it's one of these things that is just always going to be there. Even when we know that certain things are going well, there's always going to be areas for development and rooms for improvement. And I guess we're sort of looking to the next stage of that development and that improvement. We know that we do a pretty good job of making sure that everybody knows exactly what it is that they've got to do. But actually, in terms of the characteristics and the aspects of mentoring that doesn't take place filling out a form on the PLP, how are we supporting and developing and growing mentors in that? So that's where we sort of started this year, I guess, kind of wanting to scratch that itch, as Emma said. Mm. And then we've come a little bit further on our journey since then.
We have indeed.
So you're setting me a familiar scene here. I think of this as the classic Welsh education scene. It's probably the classic international education scene, but certainly round here, we value it. We're very ambitious for it to be really high quality and very multi-layered and complex, but we're not going to give it any money or resource or time. I mean, and it would be so important not to take it as a judgmental statement in a way, but just a sort of statement of pragmatic reality that there's going to be times in a mentor's life when they are probably just going to have to fall back on the absolute bare minimum requirement, because this is sort of 1 or 2% of their working life, isn't it? Well, it's 100% of ours, really, mm-hmm. which is to get the paper trail sorted and do the forms and make sure that, you know, the boxes are ticked and all of that. Whereas you've been given the job of trying to, you know, do the ambitious bit, but with absolutely, you know, minimal resources. So how did you go about dealing with this slightly poisoned chalice?
So your mentioning of sometimes mentors needing to do the kind of bare minimum made me think of two things then. One is that actually within our model, the bare minimum is actually quite a lot.
Yes.
Like we're asking them yes. to do a lot of learning and teaching observations, progress reviews, weekly meetings, weekly feedback, and we're asking them to guide student teachers with research and inquiry.
Which is new,
yeah. And it's not necessarily something that mentors would have done themselves. And we know that often that kind of prior experience of being a mentor in the past and also being mentored yourself can guide a mentor's experience. And so we're asking them to do an awful lot of stuff. And just by doing that kind of bare minimum, I guess, a mentor would be doing loads and loads of different things. And then the other thing it made me think of is Sally's work. So we've mentioned Dr. Sally Bethel before, who was a previous member of our team, and her work around having this mentor self-reflection tool links to the idea that actually a mentor's role changes depending on both themselves and their experience, but also on the student teacher that they are mentoring. And so it might be that some times, and also it might change throughout the course of their experience with that student teacher, you are providing more scaffolding, you're providing more guidance perhaps at the beginning of a PGCE course. And then towards the end, you're providing more of that kind of clinical reasoning approach, more support for that student teacher. And I think when we started the year, we took note of what had happened before and Sally's work and also our sort of underpinning principles that we talked about last time when I was on the podcast as well. So this idea of empowering mentors and senior mentors to be competent and confident in their roles. We want to maintain and develop relationships with schools. And that is a thread that we've played on a little bit more this year, I think. We also want to try and streamline processes and avoid additional workload, and we want to work in partnership as well. So we kind of bore those different things in mind. And when we first met together to discuss the reading that we'd done, those were things that we had in our head. And we started to think about the context of 4 articles, and we're going to talk about 2 of them today, mm-hmm. through the lens of what it is that we are doing at the Cardiff Partnership already.
Yeah. Absolutely that. So we'd done a lot of reflection. We were aware of the challenges. We were aware of the positive data as well. And then we were in a position to sort of read the research and discuss it sort of with all of that in mind. And it gave us a lot to think about. So probably best that we launch into just giving a little bit of a summary of what we found from those articles. So I'm going to talk about an article by Kemis, Heikkinen, Franson, Aspfors and Edwards Grove, so Kemis et al, I'll refer to it from here on in, and it's entitled Mentoring of New Teachers as a Contested Practice, Supervision, Support and Collaborative Self-Development. And what this article does is it examines sort of contested practices of mentoring newly qualified teachers. And it's important for listeners to know this, that this was about newly qualified teachers, not student teachers. Within and between Australia, New South Wales, Finland and Sweden. And what they did was that they found, by applying this theory of something called practice architectures, which I'll talk about in a minute, that these three archetypes of mentoring were present and were playing out in different ways in different contexts, depending on the practice architecture of that particular context. So I'll give some concrete examples of this in a moment. But these three archetypes of mentoring, as you could hear in the title, are mentors as supervisors, or mentoring as supervision, mentoring as support, and mentoring as collaborative development. Something that struck me about the article from the off was in the first sort of couple of pages, it says that mentoring practices do not exist in a vacuum. Mm. So mentors' behaviours and what they call in the article the sayings, doings and relatings between mentor and mentee. And in fact, any practice, the sayings and doings of practice are heavily influenced by the practice architectures of that place. So what that is all about is that sort of everything that we say in our role as a mentor, everything that we do, how we relate to the student teacher, is enmeshed in with the particular practice architectures in the site in which they unfold. So I think it was in Australia, it was mentoring as supervision was prevalent. And that's because there, and that version of mentoring sort of sees the process as one of preparing new teachers during a process of probation so that they can meet requirements for registration as fully qualified teachers. So it kind of sounds similar to what our mentors need to do as supervisors. They are the ones that need to monitor and check and grade the student teachers as they progress towards the qualified teacher status standards. And that was quite prevalent when it came to newly qualified teachers in Australia. And so if you think about it, if you're a mentor who is a supervisor or in a supervisory role, the way you relate to the student teacher, the way you talk to them, the sort of spaces you inhabit with them, the way you operate with them, your dispositions as a mentor are going to be influenced. This kind of quote here stopped us dead in our tracks. It's talking about the dispositions of a mentor who is a supervisor. It says, of that mentor, knowledge, skills and values to assist the mentee to meet the substantive, procedural and legal requirements for registration and to act as the local agent of the state registration body. So that's who you are.
But they don't fancy that label very much, a lot of them.
yeah, exactly. So then we looked at, the article looks at Sweden and it looks at mentoring as support. So in mentoring as support, this is a view of mentoring which sees it as a process of professional support and guidance for a new teacher, in which a mentor who is not usually in a supervisory relationship with a mentee assists the mentee in the development of their professional practice in the job. And then if you just look at the difference in the dispositions of the mentor in that support role, it says the aim is to act wisely and prudently to support the new teacher in their work as a colleague in the workplace and as a developing member of the profession. And then finally, we've got mentoring as collaborative development. And this was found in the Finland context. And worth mentioning in the article sort of explains the nuances of the context that sort of make these practice architectures sort of come to life, really. In Finland, they train for, I think, 5 years. They end up with a master's to become a teacher. And so basically, there's very little state intervention in mentoring. And so in Finland, mentoring as collaborative development is seen as a process to assist a new teacher to become a member of a professional community in which members participate as equals in professional dialogue aimed at their individual and collective self-development. And like, basically, we're thinking about sort of practice architectures and the kind of spaces where this takes place. They get together after work, they go for a cuppa, there's a facilitator, you know, it's not completely loose, but they are trusted because of the route that they've had, the rigor of the route into the profession. They are trusted to develop collaboratively in their own spaces and not be sort of highly supervised. So the dispositions of sort of people within that conception or archetype of mentoring is that by practicing peer group mentoring as a form of collaborative self-development, mentors and mentees are likely to develop dispositions towards engagement in a professional community committed to individual and collective self-development. So that it enhances their sense of professional autonomy. So what's the punchline then? So we read this and we were like, okay, we've got a bit of a problem here because we've got mentors who are inhabiting the role of supervisor because they have to assess student teachers, they confer QTS. But we also want them to sort of be supportive as well and take on that role where, you know, they, if we think about the clinical practice model, they become kind of co-inquirers with their student teacher. The student teacher is encouraged to ask questions and to not just take what their mentor is saying to them and become, you know, made in their image. Actually, the mentor is not, you know, is supposed to be working with them to enhance their capacity for self-reflection, for inquiry. You know, so there was a quote in the article that just hit us direct between the eyes, which said that supervision and support, I think it was in the Swedish context they were referring to here, these two approaches to mentoring jostle confusingly alongside one another, at least for some new teachers. And we thought, oh, darn. That's maybe part of the problem with our mentors is that, of course, like, you know, what are you going to default to if you are supposed to inhabit both of those roles, you're very time poor and you've got a university who says you need to do all of this paperwork and, you know, we need it by these times. You might default to, or if you're time poor, you might reduce it to your supervisory role and focus on that as your bread and butter.
I also wonder whether our visits, I know this is outside the ballpark slightly of this discussion, but obviously sometimes we go and visit mentors, don't we, and have a discussion with them about how they're grading, if you like, students and things like that. And there's possibly a question about how you frame visits by university-based teacher educators and whether the mood music of those visits sort of points at the agent of the state bit or points at the other bit.
Yeah, well, it's the only thing we actually really check, isn't it?
Yes.
Is whether they're doing the agent of the state bit kind of in alignment. We kind of moderate that. We don't necessarily, apart from, we do have some focus sometimes, don't we, on other aspects of their role, but that tends to be a little bit smaller. The bread and butter of the university's visits is, are you interpreting the standards correctly? Are you applying them correctly in this context?
So maybe we're part of the problem.
Well, and this was, you know, this is the beauty of doing this reading is that, you know, it gives you a little bit of distance to sort of see what you're doing from a different vantage point and sort of, you know, we weren't emotional about it, but we were just able to see the problems more clearly because of this theory of practice architectures, because they had named those three archetypes. We actually, in a sort of hopeful way, we kind of thought, you know, that aspirational idea of mentoring as collaborative self-development, I wonder, are we maybe aspirationally trying to instill the sort of relationships that we would like to see student teachers go on to develop with their colleagues in order to thrive in their early career teaching years and beyond, because we are encouraging them to sort of be co-inquirers with the mentor. They have collaboration as one of their standards, you know. So, you know, some of it sort of gave me hope, but some of it I think gave all of us pause for thought.
Yeah, and it definitely made us reflect on, again, I feel like I'm a broken record with this, but I think it's worth saying again, how much we're asking them to do. Mm-hmm. You know, we're asking them to do these two quite different roles. And that quote around the two roles jostling confusingly alongside, we hear from student teachers and from mentors that they feel that as well. Like, I'm supporting you. It's my job as a mentor almost to help you grow and develop. But then also I'm the one saying, no, you haven't got that. Or no, I'm going to not put you as capable in that standard. And for the student teachers, that can be very confusing. They're sort of that role as a learner, but also as a teacher, as a leader in their school. They can almost, it doesn't necessarily foster open and honest communication, I guess, when they're trying to present this front, I guess, to the mentor that they are meeting the standards, because the mentor's the one that has to ultimately say whether they are or not.
Yeah, and there's plenty of literature out there, isn't there, about this sort of thing the student teachers do about sort of strategic cooperation. They'll say one thing in university, they'll do another thing in school. They're being very canny and very sensible in many ways about keeping everybody happy. I also sort of think there's probably, I wouldn't mind betting that in our community of, what is it, getting on for 1,000 mentors probably out there, there will be mentors who are brilliantly navigating this continuum from the prescriptive supervisor that a student probably needs early on, right the way through to this really sort of co-inquiring model and back and forth in a non-linear way, absolutely brilliantly. But they're doing it despite rather than because at the moment, and they're doing it without the time and the resources. And why are we leaving it to them to work out how to do what is such a complex thing?
Yes. Yeah, and it's definitely worth saying, as we have, that their mentors are doing an incredible job. I think even mentors that are kind of just fulfilling our requirements as such are still giving an incredible amount of time and effort to supporting student teachers on their journey. And often we'll have conversations with mentors and they'll talk about how important the mentor role is to them. Securing the quality of the profession going forward is often a really common theme that comes out. And that kind of selfless, I guess, giving of their time and energies to do this work. And there are loads of mentors that are doing an absolutely incredible job of what is essentially a pretty almost impossible task that we're setting them. It's not impossible, but, you know, a really aspirational task.
And often getting rave reviews off the students, actually, to be fair to them, better than we do quite
often. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. But yeah, I think what comes out of the Chemist article is this idea around practice architectures. And it made us reflect as well on the curriculum for Wales and perhaps how when schools are doing such different things and interpreting the curriculum for their own unique context, perhaps that makes this even more challenging for mentors and student teachers as well. Like, there, it's worth keeping things the same and simple in some ways because the context that they're working in is so messy and complicated that in some ways making things crystal clear is actually really, really helpful. But then perhaps we lose a little bit of the nuance sometimes, and mentors are able to interpret things through the lens of their own context, which can be really helpful. But then sometimes we prioritize consistency and we might say, oh, actually, if you could just do it like this instead. And there's kind of mixed messages that we're giving as well.
Yeah, and we came across that in a previous episode, didn't we, Tom, when we were talking about our research and how these standards are quite aspirational, but they are not explicit in, you know, they cannot be easily interpreted in a standardized way from school to school. And so you're absolutely right, Sian, you know, difficulty, and the right thing to do is that the mentor is going, right here, this is what that's going to look like. And this is what, you know, the kids and the school are going to be expecting of you. But then they go to a different context and they're working with a different mentor who's interpreting that in a different way. And you also need the mentors to understand that is a challenge for student teachers as they make their way through the entire program. And that's a difficult thing to do when you are, you know, very much rooted in context, in your own context. Seeing yourself as a teacher educator on the Cardiff Partnership program, where your student teacher has come from somewhere else before they got to you or will go somewhere else, and therefore your role needing to be to not make them in the image of what's going on here, but to help them to navigate a different context when they go somewhere, you know, all of that just makes this a very, very challenging but actually quite appealing role because of that. Because this was the other revelation we had, wasn't it? It was that, like, you know, a mentor, we need to sort of, as a nationally, repackage and resell mentoring as a really great career opportunity and a developmental opportunity, a fundamental role within a school and within the education landscape, when actually we know anecdotally and from some evidence that we've got that actually lots of senior mentors often have to sort of
twist arms,
strong arm people into doing that role. And we've got to just face the facts that maybe that's because it's got a bit of a negative rep as one that is going to produce a lot of paperwork and you're not going to have any time to do it.
There's such an interesting bigger story here, isn't there? And I'm going to put my most cynical hat on here, which is my most well-worn hat, which is that we've got this story that is told all over the education landscape around these parts that we're being super ambitious, we're being super complex, we're almost kind of trying to import what you'd think of as a quite a Scandinavian approach to a lot of education. And we're getting rid of all those boring old constraints that we used to have and all those tick box things and look at us and how not like England we are and all that kind of stuff. And we pat ourselves on the back. And yet you pull the curtain back an inch and all the old structures and constraints are still there alive and well. We've just sort of covered them up with a gloss of optimism and happy thinking.
That's a really good segue.
Yes. That's a great segue.
That's a great segue into your article.
And here's where Sian's going to steal my cynical hat.
Oh, it's not me. I'm going to blame the author of the article. The second article that we wanted to talk about is called Educative Mentors, The Role of Classroom Teachers in Initial Teacher Education. And it's from 2017 and it's by Helen Trevethan. And she is an initial teacher education employee working in New Zealand. So she basically does our job, the role that me and Emma and Tom do, where she is based at a university and she supports student teachers and works in partnership with schools where the student teachers do placements. And so she went out into one of the schools that she had a long-standing relationship with, and she interviewed mentors working in that school at the beginning and the end of an academic year. And in between, she did some school-wide professional development, which did touch on mentoring a little bit, but also was about kind of general focuses that the school got to choose to. So she did some school-wide PD, and she also did some individual professional development with the mentors in the school. And this ITE provider was aiming for an educative mentoring approach, as the title indicates. And she defines this as, it's a theory that knowledge construction requires scaffolded support, which is timely and relevant to the individual, where the classroom is a site of inquiry and teachers are also learners who need to think about how to develop principled teaching practice. So a teacher who is acting as educative mentor for a student teacher will be willing and able to interrogate, explain, and justify their practices, and to engage in reciprocal learning relationships. So when you listen to that definition of educative mentoring, it rings really true, I think, in the education context in Wales and in our model at Cardiff Met, the research-informed clinical practice model. So that is the context that she's working in. And essentially, her number one finding is that there's a misalignment between the aspirations of the university and the mentors' perceptions of their role. And there's this kind of view that the university is preoccupied with theory and is out of touch with what's happening actually in school and in the classroom. And that definitely rang true to us when we were talking about this. We hear this from our mentors and from our senior mentors. And it also made us question the model of mentor leadership that we have at Cardiff Met. Like, at the moment, it's me and Emma and Kerry, and we get together and we work together on setting professional learning goals and targets, and we kind of use our partnership improvement plan and we collaborate with people. And occasionally maybe we get a few people in through the door from schools to say, what do you think of this? Do you think this is right? But actually, and Trevor pushed us on this, Professor Trevor Mutton, do we need to have schools joining our team? Like, do we actually need to have mentors and senior mentors as part of our mentor leadership? Because we are out of touch. We're not in the classroom. We're not at the chalk face doing this stuff day in, day out. And that's something that Trevethan found through her article. And linked to that, there was a need for increased communication and a shared understanding between schools and higher education providers in order to provide the most supportive experience for the student teacher. And again, this is something that rings true to us. Often frustrations for the student teacher are when they feel that the university and the school aren't working together. And Tom, as you mentioned earlier, often they're very canny, aren't they? They have to be this little chameleon where they're saying slightly different things in different contexts. That's not what we want them to be having to spend their time thinking about, is it? We don't want them to have to be thinking, okay, at university, they said I have to do this, so I'm going to say this to my university tutor, but then when I'm in school, I'm not actually going to do it. I'm just, you know, we don't want that to be taking up their time and their headspace.
This really rings true with the work we were talking about. Emma and I were talking about our research the other day, and one of the findings, it came quite late on in the discussion, was that quite a lot of mentors didn't really know what the students were getting at university. They weren't aware of it, and there was a little bit of a undertone with some of them of, well, you know, it's all very nice they get to go and you put your arm around them and peel them off the ceiling and, you know, sort them out. But they could be here doing something a bit more useful. And, you know, you could get annoyed about that. But then you think, well, if they never get to set foot in the building and see what goes on or co-teach it with us or even know about it, why would they have any idea or any sense that it was useful? It's another one of those, isn't it, where you want something, but you got to make it happen.
Yeah. And this idea of partnership, like they, when we were reading this initially, we wrote down a list. Well, first of all, we wrote down a list of challenges. And then we thought, you know what, there's actually some opportunities here as well. And this kind of opportunity for true partnership working, where we do collaborate more, and we obviously we have it in terms of certain groups of people, but on a ground level, this idea that the mentor would know exactly what they were getting at university just doesn't quite ring true. And I think as well, there's a bit of a disconnect here between primary and secondary too, because I know that at secondary, and I only learned this through the work that we're doing, but I know that there's subject networks that support with this. So you as a subject mentor might have some sort of connection with all of your drama mentors, for example. At primary, we don't have that because obviously there aren't specific subjects and we don't have year group networks or anything. So as a mentor in primary, I'm getting a little bit of professional learning from the university. Then perhaps I'll be observed and my judgments will be assessed. That could be it. Everything else comes through my senior mentor, apart from kind of emails every now and again. And so, yeah, this kind of increased communication to develop a shared understanding came through as a real theme. Then the third theme is that in her research, she interviewed mentors at the beginning of the year. She did some professional learning with them. She interviewed them at the end of the year. And she found that most of the mentors remained anchored by their own personal beliefs. So despite the fact that there'd been this professional learning that had been engaged in, and despite the fact that she'd poured quite a lot of time into this, actually mentors' own beliefs really hung true. And they were the things that could have sort of stood the test of time in terms of how they felt a mentor should be, the types of things that they should do. And I think that really made us reflect on what sort of practitioner a mentor needs to be in order to mentor in line with our model and our philosophy. And it's also a little bit of a reminder that doing a couple of hours of professional learning every now and again isn't going to be enough to change hearts and minds and to support mentors in perhaps kind of moving forward in their mentoring philosophy. And then another theme that sort of came through was the mentors in this discussion around what they felt a mentor should be were quite hung up on whether you need to be an expert teacher to be an expert mentor. And that was quite an interesting one as well. So some of them felt that you did need to be an expert teacher and you needed to model teaching in a really expert manner. And others felt that actually it was more important for this sort of collaborative dialogue and for the student teacher to see you as a learner. So this sort of theme around professional learning and how much impact it actually has and who mentors are and whether that matters came through quite strongly. And that was one of the ideas that sort of sparked this thought that we had to kind of create some of these principles. What type of practitioner do we think mentors need to be?
That's interesting because it's making me think of other literature I've read, and I wish I was a human Google because I'd be able to cite it. But literature which suggests that sort of university-based initial teacher education is actually a really weak intervention, if you like, for changing the value sets of student teachers by the time it's finished. We know that there is, you know, a certain amount of churn in the school-based teacher educator community. They come and go. We see them very little. That relationship is quite light touch and everything feels quite transitory, doesn't it, given the scope of what you're trying to achieve there.
Yeah, and the fact that we only have them for, what is it, like 9 months, really, and then off we go, off they go. And actually, like, we are starting to develop relationships. But I bet you guys do too, I sometimes run into past students when I'm out in schools doing visits. And it's sort of crazy to hear them reflect on their journey. Like, we're, you know, point 1A, aren't we, of a teaching career that might be 100 points long, and to hear some of the things that they've done, I sort of wish that we were able to maintain and develop those relationships.
Yeah, and I suppose there's a difference there, isn't there, even within our own programs, because on the BA they're with them for 3 years. Mm. You know, and I'm thinking about the Finland model in the article that I read. You know, imagine the luxury of being with them for 5 years.
5 years, yeah.
Imagine what we could do. So yeah, it gave us a lot of food for thought. In some ways, there were heartening aspects to what we read in terms of, you know, us. I think it's heartening in that it sort of gave credence to some of the hunches that we already had. I think we've always known in our heart of hearts that just by sort of spending an hour and a half talking about our vision for student teachers learning, giving some concrete examples and talking about clinical reasoning and how to do it, it's never going to cut it in terms of actually making a difference to their practice on the ground. We knew that in our heart of hearts. And so we were able to go into the next phase of our development of these principles with some draft principles, because that's what we did at the end of our time with Trevor, and into a room of school colleagues who were then able to help us to hone those principles from, you know, a living it on the ground perspective, working directly with mentors, and many of them have, I think all of them having been mentors themselves, to sort of, you know, tell us, did we have them right? Was there anything missing? Would we categorize them in a particular way? You know, and more broadly, to start thinking about, well, how might these principles lead us to working with mentors in a slightly different way in future when we're thinking about their professional learning offer, you know, how we hook them up with other mentors to talk about their teacher education practice. So, yeah, it really helped us to crystallise the issues, but to find a way forward.
Yeah, and we had a little bit of blank page syndrome at the beginning, didn't we?
We did.
So Professor Trevor very kindly shared with us the principles from the Oxford internship scheme. And so we kind of had a look at those and very quickly realised that we're doing quite different things. We're working in a very different context. Our mentors are doing different roles, different things. So we started by just listing everything out. Mm-hmm. And then when we got the school colleagues in the room, it was really interesting to hear their insights on, first of all, the actual kind of concept around what a mentor is, what a mentor does, what mentors need to know, all of this stuff. But also some of the things that we'd missed and some of the ways that they thought that it would be useful for us to use these principles going forward. And it was in some ways heartening, wasn't it? Because we were a bit like, oh, okay, there's quite a lot on there that we all agree with. Mm-hmm. But we're also conscious that often the reality of what's happening on the ground is quite different to what we're sort of thinking about and aware of in university. So the fact that we are kind of theoretically at least on the same page felt quite reassuring.
Yeah, it did. And the other thing that was really heartening about it was that the school colleagues in the room also felt that the role needed to be much more appealing and sort of sellable as a viable career development option. And they felt that these principles just helped them to be able to do that job a lot better, to sort of, you know, because if you look in our current clinical practice guide, we notice that we have got a role descriptor for the mentor, but it's largely a list of tasks, list of things that we are expecting them to do. It's not about what our draft principles ended up being, which is, you know, who do I need to be? What values and dispositions do I need to have? What do I need to know? What sort of practice knowledge do I need to possess? And what do I need to do? What teacher education approaches do I need to help me achieve that? And then another really great addition that the school colleagues considered was that it needs to have it so that student teachers are able to. And so we found this opportunity to marry up our vision of how student teachers learn and all of the qualities that sort of are characteristic of that and the values, knowledge and practices that a mentor would need to help that happen, to facilitate that way of learning.
Yeah, and the way that the school colleagues grouped those things just hadn't really kind of appeared to us, had it? When we were sort of looking at this list and we were thinking like, oh gosh, yeah, all of these things are really important. But actually you can sort of separate it into these three different areas. And afterwards, so we We got all of the principles, we cut them all up, we did, it was a very primary school teacher activity actually, I take full credit for it, not really, but you know, got lots of bits of paper and were able to sort these things into these different groups. And then the next thing that we are sort of considering is how do we make this land? Because we are very good at creating lots of things,
oh,
aren't we?
Yes.
We're
yes.
so good at creating oh, yes. lots of things.
And then we bury them 85 folders deep somewhere where no one can find them and wonder why it's had no impact.
Exactly. So I think we want mentors to have this aspirational idea. I've said the word, I've said it aspirational. This aspirational mm-hmm. idea of who it is that we want them to be and all of those other things that Emma just mentioned. But actually, what do we need to do in order to support mentors to know about this, engage with it, and also use it as potentially a bit of a tool for self-development? So one of the ideas is that we should make them shorter. So we've had a little go at making them shorter as well. And this is kind of where we're at now, because sometimes, in some ways, making things a little bit shorter feels like we're losing a little bit of the nuance, perhaps, of some of it. But what's the point in giving something if it's going to be too long and too wordy and no one's actually going to read it? So this is where we're at the moment. So our next stage is to go back to some school colleagues with where we've got so far and to think, actually, like, is it worth having a bit of extra context in there, or would it be better to make it shorter, maybe lose a bit of the nuance, but then it actually will land a little bit more?
Yeah, and I guess I'm, you know, I'm speaking for myself now, but my hunch is that when we did a comparison of the longer and shorter versions, what we sort of felt, I think, Sian, was that the essence of what it means to be a mentor in a research-informed clinical practice model kind of got lost. So an example of this would be, so mentors in a clinical practice model, like, they need to sort of be aware that they have their own beliefs, experiences, and philosophy of teaching, and that has had a bearing on their teaching. That's the kind of long-winded version. And then if you scroll down to what that becomes in the shortened version, is mentors are self-aware. So
all right, if you've been through the long one first, as a little thing to stick on your office wall, but perhaps you wouldn't want to start with that.
Perhaps you wouldn't start with that. And you know, we're thinking ahead, of course, to like the sort of practical application of how you might use these with mentors. You know, you could have a whole conversation and self-reflection or collaborative reflective moment about, what do I believe as a teacher? What are my experiences? How has my philosophy, rightly or wrongly, influenced my practice as a mentor in the past and the way I've worked with student teachers? You know, is that something I should be thinking about? And do I need to unpack that and lay that bare for the student teacher? You know, what's the upshot of that? But, you know, we also have to do it in the spirit of co-construction. So we need to get our school colleagues take on that.
Yeah, and I think the point around whether something is too long to actually be used is a really good one. So I don't know. I don't know where they're going to go with it, to be honest. Like, we were pleasantly surprised, weren't we, by how quickly they were able to kind of give us new insight. Us that have been staring at this sheet of paper for hours and hours, all of a sudden, you know, and fresh pair of eyes with the practice knowledge and the context knowledge, looked at it and immediately made it better than we'd made it ourselves. So we're hoping that they're going to solve this problem for us, right?
We're hoping. I think, you know, this is why we need to work in partnership, because they will bring, and this is not all they bring, you know, what I don't want to do here is to sort of create this binary of, you know, school for practice and university for theory. Like, we've done a lot to try and unpack that. But, you know, they bring the reality check of how are we going to make this land with mentors who are busy, who are time poor, and, you know, who just really want to know, you know, what the role is all about without having to sort of get into the nuances of it. But then we also know, as university colleagues who are engaging with this theory, you know, and we know what it might look like if we go in a different direction, in a different model, and what, you know, what makes us distinctive here, and then what makes that offer really appealing to mentors, that we sort of need to keep a bit of a check and balance. So they're keeping checks and balances on us.
Yeah.
And I think it works both ways.
Well, I think that sounds like a really valuable process. Obviously, it's not finished yet. It's in draft. I can see it's got watermarks all over it saying, do not put this out in the world or I'll come around your house. So we're not releasing the audiobook of the Mentor Principles on this episode. Maybe maybe that's a way we could do it, an audio version. they'll like that. but presumably you've got a bit of a plan for what this is going to do out there in the world, in the massive bag of contradictions that is the teacher education world in reality. So where are you off with these principles next?
Well, we've got another day working with school colleagues coming up very soon, where we'll reiterate them. But in the meantime, we've asked them to take them to their mentors, sort of by way of questions. So we've recrafted them into the principles into questions, and we're asking them to present those questions to their mentors in whatever way works for them. So some of them might do it as a little survey online, or some of them might get them together in person as a bit of a focus group, and then they're going to come back sort of giving us that intel about how they landed with the mentors. What they're also going to glean from that, we hope, is aspects of the role of the mentor within our model that we might need to address through future professional learning. So, you know, if a lot of them didn't really, you know, didn't really recognize that bit about your own personal beliefs, you know, and how they influence the way you work with a student teacher, well, then we maybe need to plan some sessions on that, and schools can maybe, you know, work with mentors in situ in their contexts to develop their practice in that area.
Yeah, and I think long term, if this is what we think mentoring is about, and this is the type of mentors that we want to see in our partnership, it will become our professional learning offer. Mm-hmm. So we'll hopefully, we're at a point, I think, in the partnership where we can move beyond perhaps kind of to-do lists and things. Like, obviously, those things will still need to exist. We'll still need to do the sort of procedural, operational training, especially when people are new to the role and new to the job. But then once someone is established as a mentor, they know how to fill out the forms, etc. Perhaps these principles will form the type of engagement with professional learning that they want to have. So maybe there'd be choice. Maybe mentors will be able to opt in to different sessions. Maybe we would provide some sort of suite of training resources, professional learning resources. Maybe schools would pick one that they want to work on with their mentors this year. So yeah, I think it's quite exciting to be able to sort of drill down into the actual fundamental principles of what the role is.
Well, there we go. There's three people around the table who've managed to craft mentoring into something of an interesting career. Probably should finish by saying we love you all, mentors.
We do.
We know what you do. We know we don't give you enough goodies. And as they say across the pond, thank you for your service.
Indeed.
Yeah, in a different context. Okay, so we will continue talking about mentoring, I'm sure, at intervals, because it is so vitally important. But we're going to move on now to our short slots. And Emma has something interesting.
I do. And this was another of the chapters that Professor Trevor Mutton recommended to us. It's an oldie bit of goodie. It's 1994, so it's got a vintage to it. But this is by Hazel Hagger, Donald McIntyre, and an M. Wilkin. I don't know who M. Wilkin is, but they worked together on this chapter of a book. The chapter title is Mentoring: Perspectives on School-Based Teacher Education. And what this chapter does is, it, again, a bit like The Chemist, it sort of categorises different approaches to mentoring. It gives really interesting points of reflection about how the different models can sort of throw up different dangers within the relationship between student, teacher and mentor. And it makes a very strong case at the end of it for partnership between university and school, and the sort of complexity and sophistication that's required to mentor student teachers effectively. So, yeah, we found this another very, very useful chapter to read. And it's not an impenetrable one either. It's written sort of...
It's quite an easy read.
It's an easy read. So yeah, that would be my recommendation if you want to read more on this topic.
Yeah, more from the Oxford team, who do a very good job of making really complex stuff accessible. Definitely an advert for not cloaking things in obscurity unnecessarily. Okay, Sian, you have something to try.
So our reflection on this process was that it's been really interesting breaking down the role of the mentor into its core purpose and the core principles. And it got us thinking about other roles and other aspects of teachers' lives that perhaps this might be a useful thing to try. So if you've got a particular role, maybe you're a subject leader, maybe you're a phase leader, maybe a head of year, you've got some sort of role as part of your job. Have you thought about drilling it down into the key principles that makes you effective in that role? And it got me thinking about when I used to be, many years ago, I used to be music subject leader.
Oh, lovely.
I know. And I remember at the time I became very obsessed with my to-do list. And things on my to-do list were things like making sure every classroom, this was primary, had an instrument box and organising the instrument cupboard and things like that. And I remember meeting with a mentor at the time who encouraged me to do this, to think, actually, what type of a music subject leader do you want to be? What are your priorities from a more holistic perspective, and really got me to refocus my time and energies. And essentially, this is what I was doing. I was drilling the job down to its principles. So if you've got one of those roles and you are thinking about your to-do list, perhaps slant a little bit, pivot, and think about what are the principles of this role that would make me do a really good job.
Oh, that's a brilliant suggestion, because things do tend to get encrusted with pointless things that actually just are there because they've always been there. Yes. Yeah. So there we go. Have a drill down into that role. Music instrument boxes for all. Right. Oh, well, thank you. I've done very little today. It's been very nice. You two have done tons of work. Loads on mentoring there. And I'm sure we'll be returning to that subject. But that's us done for now in this episode. And we will be back with you in 2 weeks' time. You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. Thanks to our colleague Sian Wickersham for joining us in the studio today to talk about mentoring, and thanks to all those mentors out there for all the work you do. We really appreciate it. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. Technical support from Peter Lambourne, and the studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.